We've been talking about how God has been training and disciplining his son. And when I say his son, I'm not talking about Jesus. Who's God's son in the Old Testament?
Israel.
Right. God called Israel his son, his firstborn son, when he was speaking to Moses. And Moses was commanded to go to Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh to let my son go, that he may come and serve me. And then we see, beginning with the Exodus, we see God bringing Israel out into the wilderness to give them his law, and then to begin to train them in a very interactive way. That is, God interacting with his people very directly. Now, I want you to take your Bibles and turn to Exodus chapter 23. Excuse me. I want to point out something that God said to Moses early on, right after he brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. And you know that God had promised through Moses to bring them to the promised land, a land that he said was flowing with milk and honey. And he talked about how that he was going to go with them, how he was going to go into the land and defeat their enemies for them. All they had to do was be obedient. Now, in Exodus chapter 23, I want you to see what God said about the fact that they were to completely drive the people out of the land when God brought them in. He did not want them leaving any of the indigenous peoples to continue to live in the land. Now, he didn't mean to kill them all, but he did say to drive them out. That is, make sure that they completely were driven out of that land. And he tells them why here in Exodus chapter 23. Let's begin reading in verse 27. I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, the Hittite from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. Little by little, I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and you inherit the land. And I will set your bounds from the Red Sea to the sea, Philistia, and from the desert to the river. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you to sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Now, the reason God wanted them to completely drive out all the other people from this area that he was giving them, was what? Why didn't he allow them to, you know, allow some of them to remain?
So that they wouldn't be a snare.
All right. And the fact that they were pagans, that they worshiped false gods, it would infect God's people, right? That was his reason for that. It's the same reason that God forbid them in other places from intermarrying with the pagan races of people, because when you do that, they're going to bring their false religions in, and it's going to, you know, mix with God's people, and God's people are going to then serve idols. And that was constantly a problem. So it's very clear that what God said was that, what he commanded was that they must, after God allowed them to conquer these other nations, that they then were to drive all the remaining inhabitants completely out of the land, not allow them in their borders, not to live in their borders, right? All right, now when we get to Joshua, and we see God going before Joshua into the land. We pointed out last time that the angel of the Lord met Joshua, said that he was going to go before and fight the battles. And we see that happening at Jericho. Jericho is the first instance where we see this miraculous military victory that was clearly not because of the superior military strength of the Israelites. They certainly were not superior, either in numbers or in, you know, weapons or anything like that. But God knocked down the walls of Jericho because they were obedient to him. And then we see that, excuse me, that on the next city that they were going to conquer, that they they sinned against God, and so God just, you know, he let them go at it without his presence, and they had to turn tail and run in that instance. And then, of course, you know, as we pointed out in Joshua 6, God explained to them why that was the case. If they wanted his presence to be with them to defeat all these nations, they were going to have to obey him. It was as simple as that. And if they would not obey him, then he was just going to back off and let them do it their way, and they fall flat on their face every time. All right? And these are important lessons. Now, I want you to turn to the book of Judges. We're kind of skipping over most of Joshua. Joshua is basically about the various nations that they defeated in the land and how that came about. And how finally, after a 10-year period, Joshua then finally divided up the remainder of the land to the 12 tribes, and he sent them home to their new land to farm. But part of their job, even though they had conquered a various land and Joshua had divided it up amongst them, part of their job was to make sure that they drove out any remaining people out of the land. All right, God required that they do that. Now, when we come to the book of Judges, we see that the Israelites didn't do that. They failed to do that as God had commanded them. Even after he had, you know, given them this land in such a miraculous and supernatural way, they failed him completely. Let's go to Judges chapter 1. Does it feel warm in here to anybody else besides me?
Yes.
All right, we're going to fix that right now. Judges chapter 1, verse 26. However, Manasseh, now Manasseh is one of the tribes, okay? One of the tribes of Israel. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-shean and its villages, or Tanakh and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. And it came to pass, when Israel was strong, that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. In other words, they were taxing them instead of, you know, forcing them to leave the land. Nor did Ephraim, that's another tribe, drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer. So the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. Nor did Zebulun, this is another one of the tribes, drive out the inhabitants of Kitron, or the inhabitants of Nahalal. Or so the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. Nor did Asher, this is another tribe of Israel, drive out the inhabitants of Akko, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or Alab, or Askzib, and the other cities there, I'm not going to pronounce them. So the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites and inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Nor did Naphtali, this is another tribe of Israel, drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, or the inhabitants of Beth Anath. But they dwelt among the Canaanites and inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath were put under tribute to them. Look what they're doing. They're, instead of doing what God said, which was make sure that they leave the land, force them out, they're simply taxing them. So you can live here. We conquered you. You're a conquered people, but you have to pay taxes to us. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down to the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres, in Ajalon, and in whatever that is. Yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Now the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah and upward. Now, many of these tribes failed to do what God said. God insisted that they drive them out. They didn't do it. So what happens? Look at chapter 2, verse 1. Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and said, "Now who is the angel of the Lord? We've met him before in several on several occasions. Who is the angel of the Lord?" It's Christ. We know that because the New Testament speaks of Christ appearing in certain instances in the Old Testament. And if you go to the Old Testament passages, it says it was the angel of the Lord. We see this in the burning bush. When Moses went to see the burning bush, it says that the angel of the Lord called to Moses out of the burning bush. And Jesus, in John chapter 8, identifies himself as the one who appeared to Moses. He identifies himself in that passage as the one who appeared to Abraham, and so forth. All right, so in chapter 2, it says that the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, "I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I," now notice this, "which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you." Isn't that interesting? Now, the Bible says that God made a covenant with the Israelites, but the angel of the Lord is referring to that in the first person. I did this. Yes?
The word angel really is messenger. So
right.
Really, the proper translation
yes.
would be messenger of the Lord.
That's right. And Christ is the messenger. In fact, the New Testament refers to Christ with the word angel as well, but you have to get out of your head the idea that an angel is some certain kind of creature, because that's not the way the Bible uses the term. The word angel is simply the word messenger. Whether it's referring to a person, a human being, whether it's referring to Jesus Christ, the Son of God, or whether it's referring to the spirit beings who are God's messengers, like Gabriel and Michael and so forth, the word messenger simply has to do with their role in what they're doing as opposed to what they are, okay? So unfortunately, because the word angel has not been, it's one of those terms that the Bible translators have failed to translate. You know, we've talked a little bit before about this idea of whether somebody translates a term or they transliterates a term. What does transliterate mean? Okay, right. They take the sound of the word in one language and they use, you know, the alphabet of the other language to try to make the same sound, the same phonetic sound. And in the Greek, the word angel is angelos. Well, actually, the word messenger in Greek is angelos. And when they translate the Bible, instead of translating angelos as messenger, which is what it means in Greek, they didn't translate it. Instead, they transliterate it to angel. And that's how we got the word angel, all right? And now what that does is, because the word is not actually translated, is the real meaning of the word gets lost in translation, and instead a different meaning gets absorbed by the new word in the other language. And that's what's happened in English with the word angel, okay? It simply means a messenger. That's all it meant in the original languages. It doesn't necessarily mean some supernatural being with wings or something like that. All right, so it's important that you know that, because some people, when they see this and they make the connections with what the New Testament, how it refers to Christ as this person who was appearing to Abraham or appearing to Moses or appearing to Joshua and so forth, it makes the connection of an angel, and so then they come to the conclusion that, well, Jesus was just an angel. That is, he was a created being, you know, supernatural being. And that's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that Jesus was the Son of God, not a created being. Okay? So we need to make that distinction. All right. So it says that this angel, the angel of the Lord, which is a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ, came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, "I led you from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you." Now, what other term is used of this person who brought the children of Israel through the wilderness to the promised land in Deuteronomy? Besides the angel of the Lord, there's another term. Besides the name of God, the rock. In the Song of Moses, he's called the rock. And repeatedly in Deuteronomy 32, how that you know, Israel, their rock brought them, and then Israel rejected their rock and all this kind of stuff. It's the same person as the angel of the Lord here. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul refers to that, and he says that that rock in the wilderness, that that rock that that's referred to metaphorically as a rock, was Christ. Paul says that. So we know very definitely that it was Christ who was the one who these passages are talking about. The New Testament tells us that explicitly. So, again, back to chapter 2, verse 1. I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. So it was, when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voices and wept. Then they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. And when Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works which the Lord, he had done for Israel. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. And they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gash. Now I want you to notice this. This is very important, beginning in verse 10. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers. Now, before we go on, who is all that generation?
The one from the 40 years in the desert.
Right. They were the children of the original group that came out of Egypt. Right? God brought the Israelites out of Egypt, but because of their rebellion, he said that those 20 years old and older were going to die in the wilderness, and he would bring their children into the promised land. So he waited 40 years to bring them into the land. So that was the children of the first generation. And now the second generation, who Joshua led into the promised land, and they saw God working in these miraculous ways to defeat all of their enemies. This generation now has come to an end. And their children are growing up. The second generation is dying off. And what happens? Look what happens. Verse 10. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. Wait a minute. How could they not know? How could the children of the generation of Israelites, whom God brought into the land, who witnessed all his miracles of defeating all of these enemies? And you can read about it all through the book of Joshua, how over and over God defeated their enemies for them in miraculous ways. How could the next generation not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel? I want you to tell me, how could they not know that? Yeah, is that what you think? What do you think, Vera?
Same thing.
What do you think? That's exactly right. Their parents failed to teach them about this God and about all his mighty works that he had done. They failed to teach their children history, their own history. Isn't that right? That's the only way they could not know. So what happened? Verse 11, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. Those were false gods. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. That is, the ones they were supposed to drive out of the land, but they failed to do so. The previous generation had failed to do so. You know what? You've got two factors going on here. One, the generation under Joshua did not obey what God said. God supernaturally conquered these peoples But they were to make sure that they drove the rest of them completely out of the land. And they, there's, we just read in Judges chapter 1, this whole long list of how the tribes didn't do that. And now they didn't teach their children about God and about his mighty works and how he brought the children of Israel out of Egypt and all the miracles that he did and so forth. And so now this third generation, what are they doing? They're worshiping false gods, the gods of the nations that they didn't drive out. Just like God said they would do, right? He said that was going to happen, and that's exactly what happened. Yes, Walt.
Nothing is you today. You're the same thing is here today, too. A lot of families have failed to pass on God's word, and now we look at the generations, how more people are drifting away from God and following false gods.
Now, see, we live in a culture. We live in a world where we cannot completely insulate ourselves and our children from the influence of all the idolatry and the false nonsense that's around us, because they've got to go to school. We are not a theocracy. We're a democracy, supposedly, right? And we live amongst pagans. We live amongst people that do not worship God. They worship money, or they worship fame, or rock stars, or that's what they worship. They don't worship the true God. And so our children are exposed to that. Now, doesn't that make us teaching them even more important than it did for the children of Israel, who were, if they were able to isolate themselves from all that like God commanded them and live as a theocracy, that is, a nation truly under God, governed by God's laws, with just judges and so forth, if they could have lived in that scenario, and if they could have taught their children as they should have, then the next generation would not have departed from God. But they failed on both counts. My point is that this should drive home to us how critical it is that we train our children from the time they're extremely little until they're adults, and that How are they going to learn? How do children learn the things of God, and to behave as Christ wants them to behave? How do they learn that?
By example, behavior.
Okay, by example or observation, which is example, right? Mm-hmm. Not only that, by repetition, which means you bring them to the house of God every week, right? If your kids don't see you being consistent with the things of God, what are they going to conclude?
That they don't have to be consistent either.
They're not that important. If they're not that important to you, they're not going to be important to your kids. Plus, they've got the influence of all the world around them pulling them away as well. And believe me, that's a very powerful influence, especially if you have a TV or a computer in your home that your kids have access to. Right? It's just sucking them away from the things of God. It's extremely important that the fathers are consistent, that they show how much value there is to the things of God and the importance of those things to their children. But anyway, that was just a little side sermon there. All right, let's continue reading. Chapter 2 of Judges, verse 13. They forsook the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtoreths, and the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. So he delivered them into the hands of plunderers, who despoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Now, prior to this, God gave them supernatural ability in warfare to prevail. In fact, he said through Moses that he was going to send hornets in to chase their enemies. And God did many things, as you read through the book of Judges. He did many things, supernatural things, to help them defeat their enemies when they were obedient to God. But what we see as we continue through the book of Judges is this cycle develops. A cycle of them forgetting God, God then turning them over to their enemies, who then begin to oppress them, just like the Egyptians had oppressed them when they were in slavery in Egypt. It goes back into this cycle of slavery and being oppressed by foreign powers and so forth until what happens? They cry out to God. They return to the God of their fathers. And then what does God do? He delivers them. And we see this cycle go over and over and over. The entire book of Judges is this cycle like this, of the Israelites forsaking God when things are good, worshiping false gods and so forth, and then when God brings calamity on them to judge them, then after a while they're crying back out to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of their fathers. And God pities them, and he brings them back. And we see this constantly throughout this entire book. Let's continue reading verse 15. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn to them. And they were greatly distressed. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but they played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do so. And when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of that judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by the groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass when the judge was dead that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings nor from their stubborn way. Then the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not heeded my voice, I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died. In other words, God had promised them the supernatural power to be able to overcome all these peoples that were living amongst them and to be able to drive them out. And what he's saying is, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to provide that supernatural power to do that anymore. Verse 22, so that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of the Lord or walk in them as their fathers kept them or not. Another testing. He's going to leave the foreign nations in there to test them. Generation after generation, he's going to test them to see if they'll obey his law or if they will succumb to these other foreign gods. And why is he doing that? Because what he's doing is he's sorting them. He is destroying the ones who will not follow him. That's what he's doing. It's a sifting process. That's what this testing is all about. Now look at chapter 3. Now, these are the nations which the Lord left, that he might test Israel by them. Actually, let's skip down to verse. I got to pick up my pace. So let's go down to verse 5. Thus the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And those are the nations that God said that he was going to drive out before. And they took their daughters to be their wives, and they gave their daughters to their sons, and they served their gods. So the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and Ashtoreth. Therefore the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of Cushan-Rethiam, king of Mesopotamia. And the children of Israel served Cushan-Rethiam 8 years. When the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the children of Israel who delivered them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. Then the spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. He went out to war, and the Lord delivered Cushan-Rethiam, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand. And his hand prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. So the land had rest for 40 years. Then Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. And the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so that the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. And he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, went and defeated Israel, and took possession of the city of Palms. That's Jericho, by the way. So the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. But when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, a left-handed man. By him the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. I'm not going to continue reading how he defeated him and all that. But you just get a little taste at the beginning of Judges of how this cycle went. They went, you know, they forsook God. They worshiped the foreign gods. They intermarried amongst the pagan tribes around them. God punished them by raising up their enemies to come in and defeat them. And then after, you know, their serving these other nations became so bitter, God delivers them again. He has pity on them. They cry out to God. And this cycle goes over and over and over. The entire book of Judges is this cycle of Israel rejecting God, God allowing their enemies to come and punish them, and then them crying back out to God, and then him delivering them again. And it's again and again and again and again and again through all the judges until we come to Samuel towards the end of the book. Samuel then was a judge. Now, you'd think, if this is going on generation after generation after generation after generation, that it would get through their thick heads of what they're doing wrong. Don't you think? I mean, it's pretty simple. You know, these judges, God spoke directly to them. They were what we might call prophet judges. You know, the nations around them had kings. But Israel didn't have a king. They had these judges. Now, Moses was the first prophet judge of Israel. And God communicated directly with him as the leader. And they had God's law, which was the law of Moses, to govern them as a nation. And so these judges, their job essentially was to interpret the law that God had given through Moses for the children of Israel and to govern that way. But again, as soon as they have a little taste of victory, then they turn away from God again, again and again and again. All right, so we see that whole system of judges was an utter failure. Now, is it because God established a system that was defective? Was it God's fault that the system of judges that Israel had didn't work? Where was the fault? Where did the fault lie? Whose fault was it that this system continued to fail? Time after time after time after time. The system of government. It's the people's fault. And why? What were they doing? They refused to obey God. They refused to obey him. Every time he would prosper them, they would turn away from him. And then when they're, you know, in all this oppression, then he would have pity on them. And this thing just went on and on and on. All right, so the whole situation begins to change when we get to the book of Samuel. I want you to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8. Samuel was the last judge. And he was also a prophet of God. Yes, 1 Samuel chapter 8. Let's begin in verse 1. Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now he knows, see, in the past, it was obvious that when the good judge died, the Israelites went wild. They went wild again, right? So what does Samuel do? He takes his own sons and he makes them judges. And Samuel's God's prophet, all right? Well, let's see how well that worked out. He made his son judges over Israel. The name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second Abijah, and they were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They took bribes. They perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "Look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to the Lord. Now, this ought to tell you, here's Samuel, God's prophet. Samuel walked with God from the time he was a child. If you remember the story, his mother Hannah prayed because she was barren and God gave her a son. And he was raised in the temple of God his whole life. And he became God's prophet. But his own sons would not walk in his ways. This shows you how powerful the corruption was around them and how it permeated even God's own men, even their sons as well. Verse 7, and the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you. Now I want you to notice this next phrase. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. See, prior to this, from the time of Moses until this time, God was the king of the nation of Israel. And Moses and then Joshua and then these other judges were simply God's representative on earth, carrying out the commandments that God had given through Moses at the very beginning. So they were sort of standing in for the king who wasn't there personally. But the idea was God is our king. All the nations around them had a human king who basically whatever he said, that was law. That's the way those nations worked, right? If the king decided tomorrow that all the rich people have to give their wealth to all the poor people, that was the law of the land, and they had to do it. See, the king became the sovereign. The judges were not sovereign. The judges were simply to interpret the law that God had given to Moses and judge the people according to the law that God had given, because God was the sovereign. All right? But now the people of Israel want their own king besides God. God being their king, that's not good enough for them. They want a king, just like all the other nations around them. And so how does, you know, God is offended by that, isn't he? He was offended. He says, Samuel, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me by asking for a king. Because they don't want me, God, to be their king over them. They want a human to be their king. And so, you know what God did? He did what he does very often. And that is, he answers their request and he gives them what they want, even though he knows it's going to be a total disaster for them. But he gave them what they asked for. Why? Do you ever do that for your kids? Do you ever give your kids something you know is not good, but you give it to them anyway in order so that they can find out the hard way of what's going to happen? Anybody ever do that with their kid? I see Vera back there waving at me. That's what God did. You know, the thing is, our kids, they don't believe us sometimes. We have experience. We have a lot of experience. We've learned the hard way a lot of lessons in our own lives. How many of you have learned some lessons the hard way? And when you try to talk to your children and give them the benefit of your experience because you've already tried it that way and you've seen your friends try it that way and you see how that's a train wreck waiting to happen, but you tell your children and they're like, oh, they're old farts, they don't know what they're talking about. You know, right? I'm smarter than my parents. There's a saying that I heard a while back. It's something like, the older I get, the smarter my father gets. You know what I'm talking about? All right. Kids learn, they learn their lessons the hard way too sometimes. And God gives them what they ask for just because they won't learn any other way. They have to have their own train wreck and learn from their own mistakes as opposed to learning from their parents' mistakes. Well, so God gives them Saul. Let's look at verse 9. Now therefore heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. In other words, he's saying, look, go ahead and give them a king, but when you do that, you tell them what's going to happen to them when they have a king. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them over his chariots to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. He will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest. In other words, he's going to live large at the expense of your children. And some will make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take, look, you know what he's talking about? He's going to tax the snot out of you. He's going to take away your stuff. Isn't that what's happening now in our country? I mean, they're taxing us to the point where it's become, you know, almost unbearable. But that's what he's saying. This is what's going to happen to you. You're going to be paying so that the king and the government can live large on your dime. And he will take your servants and your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. Oh, boy, this is becoming a broken record, isn't it? And they said, no, but we want a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Oh, it wasn't good enough that God went before them and fought their battles, like he did at Jericho, like he parted the Red Sea, like he defeated Pharaoh's armies. That wasn't good enough for them. They wanted a king to lead them into battle. So God is saying, okay, you can have a king, but you're not going to have my presence. You want to do it your way? Okay, do it your way. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. So the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice and make them a king. And Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. The next chapter, we're not going to read it because I'm running out of time, but the next chapter is all about Saul being anointed king. Saul was the most good-looking, muscular, tall guy that they could find. Kind of looked like Isaac back there. And Samari. Big, built, you know, look like people would want to follow this guy. All right. In fact, the Bible says that he was head and shoulders taller than the rest of the people. He was tall. And so he was appointed king. But what did Saul do? It went to his head. We're not going to read all of what Saul did, but basically, Saul became an apostate. Next one. God commanded through Samuel to tell Saul to go and defeat particular peoples that were utterly wicked, and he told them to make sure that they killed them all and didn't leave anyone to escape. And also, just like he did at Jericho, he told them not to take their stuff. Right? Kill them all and destroy all their stuff. But what happened? Saul comes back from the battle, and he has the king still alive as a prisoner. They took all the best stuff from this nation, and Samuel met him. And Samuel informed him. Well, first of all, Saul starts making excuses, right? He started blaming the people. Samuel, you know, said, didn't God say don't take any of the stuff? Oh, well, you know, we did what God said. Then how come I hear all these sheep coming back with you? So Samuel told Saul that because that Saul had disobeyed God, that God was going to cut him off from being the king of Israel and raise up another king after him. And we'll see that that was David. But what does Saul do? After God rejects him, secretly God told Samuel to go and find another young man that he was going to make king, who was David. David was just a shepherd boy. But instead of God doing what he did the first time, which was having Samuel appoint the best looking, built, muscular leader that Israel could produce, he had Samuel go and find a little shepherd boy who was tending the flocks, which was a low means of of earning a living in those days. To find this guy from a humble background, and God said, I'm going to make him a king instead of the guy who was, you know, what you would think would be a natural leader by, you know, human standards. He says, I'm going to go choose this guy from a humble upbringing. Well, I'll just briefly tell you the rest of the story with Saul. Right after that, David, you know, the story of David and Goliath, right? David, Saul, had, the armies of the Philistines came to try to conquer the Israelites, and Saul was afraid to go to battle against them because they had a giant named Goliath. And David, this little shepherd boy, he says, you know, he trusted in the Lord. He said, the Lord will defeat our enemies. So he went into battle and he killed Goliath with the one shot to the forehead. And then Saul became bitter and angry against David because David was getting all the praise and Saul was not getting the praise. And so for many years, actually, Saul hunted David and tried to kill him. Hearing, of course, that Samuel had secretly anointed him to be the next king, and God had rejected Saul, and so Saul just had this vendetta that he was going to kill David. And we see that happening throughout the rest of 1 Samuel. So we won't go there. All right. What lessons can we learn from this so far? Remember, the New Testament says that all this happened to Israel and was written down for our instruction, for our learning. They're the ones that took a whipping time and time again, made all the mistakes, took a whipping, and God recorded it all so that we can observe and we can learn from their mistakes so that we don't have to go through what they went through. So we don't have to suffer the kinds of things that they suffered. That's why it's there. That's why it's extremely important that we study the history of Israel and the Old Testament, because that's what it's there for, to teach us about God, to teach us about God's consistency, about the fact that he means what he says, how, you know, his threats, all of that stuff. So what lessons can we get just from this? Go ahead, Kath.
It looks very, very bad for our country.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. I think Isaac's hand went up first.
Make sure you train up your children. Pass on the instructions that you learn to your children.
And set the example, right?
Set the example.
Samari?
Learn from your mistakes and don't keep making the same mistakes.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good one. Don't keep making the... See, Israel, time after time after time, they kept making the same mistake, and they kept having the same outcome every time. You'd think that they would learn, right? But they're stubborn and bullheaded, and they kept... Not that they're any more stubborn than anybody else. It's just that God put them in this situation to show us what humanity is like. And if you will actually follow God's commands and love the Lord our God and walk in his ways, how he will prosper us and how he prosper them as a people. But when you want to do it your way and you want to throw off God from being your king, which our nation did a long time ago, the whole "in God we trust" thing is a bunch of rubbish now, as far as America is concerned, because it's not true. God has been cut out of this country, just like he was cut out of Israel. And you know, we can't be surprised, we ought not be surprised, when the same kind of calamities come upon us that came upon the children of Israel when they cut God out as well, right? What else? Anything else? Samari?
It actually shows the mercy of God, too.
Yeah, it really does. That even when Israel was being punished and they cried out to God, he heard their prayer and he sent them a deliverer time and time and time and time again. He did that. Is God consistent?
Yes.
He's the same, right? All right. Anything else? Any other questions, comments? All right, for next week, you need to read chapter 7 in Masoreth. We're going to be talking about David, King David. God said of David that he was a man after his own heart. David wrote most of the Psalms, praise to God and so forth. He was a righteous king. He wasn't perfect. He made his mistakes too. But because of his heart, God was a lot more merciful to David in his mistakes than he was to Saul in his mistakes. All right, but we'll look at that next time.